Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Imagine a quiet Scottish town, tucked into the misty, moss-covered folds of Renfrewshire. It's the late 17th century. There's a sound to this place worth noting, not the modern hum of traffic or the clink of flasks, but the slow, insistent life of a village held together by habit and weather. Church bells mark the hour, dogs slanking under low eaves. The road is a ribbon of packed mud and puddles that catch the gray sky. Peat fires cough from low chimneys, and when the wind comes down off the hills, it carries a salt tang and the thin, persistent tang of iron from the smithy. At dusk, the town compresses. Shutters are latched. Horses stomp in the stalls, and the streets empty, save for a single lantern swinging like a tired eye. In that hush, rumor moves faster than the sheriff. A whisper, the quick passing of a child, a sack drops too loudly. Small things look larger there, and fears keep good company with daily chores. The air is thick with the chill of early spring. Smoke rises from low stone chimneys, and the rhythm of life is slow, predictable. Women carry baskets to market stalls. Children dart between cobblestones, and neighbors linger by wells to trade gossip. The smell of peat fires mingles with the earthy scent of damp, narrow streets. To an outsider, Paisley in 1697 might have looked peaceful, even ordinary. But just beneath the surface, a shadow of suspicion and fear was waiting. A shadow that would not only consume a community, but also leave a scar that time itself would struggle to heal. Paisley in 1697 was not the bustling industrial town it would later become. It was a modest settlement, its abbey dominating the skyline with cottages clustered along narrow, muddy streets. The river cart ran through, providing water, and with it, smells of fish, tannery waste, and smoke drifting from peat fires. Life was simple and hard. People woke with the sun, worked fields or looms, and traded goods in the market square where vendors shouted out the prices of salted fish, barley, and wood. Children darted between stalls, chasing dogs and each other through the muck. By night, the streets were unlit, lit only by the glow of hearth spilling from doorways or the rare flicker of a lantern. Shadows stretched long, and superstition filled the gaps left by silence. Neighbors leaned over garden fences to share gossip. Wasn't it strange that old Margaret's cow gave milk when everyone else's had dried up in winter? Did you hear how John Reed muttered to himself when no one was listening? Most families owned little more than the clothes on their backs, a pot for cooking, and a straw bed. Winter was brutal, bringing hunger and frostbite, and death was always near. From illness, accident, or childbirth. The fragility of life meant people looked for explanations anywhere they could find them. If a misfortune struck, it wasn't just chance. It was the result of someone's malice, someone's spell. In that context, the ideas of witches wasn't wild or supernatural. It was the most logical explanation available. And we must appreciate the closeness of this existence. This was a place where people lived on top of each other. The average house in Paisley was low. Single-story stone structure with a communal water source and open drainage running right through the streets. There was no real privacy. Illnesses were shared as quickly as secrets. Smells were inescapable, and strangers, even those from the next village, were immediately conspicuous. It was this atmosphere of relentless proximity. Suspicion didn't have to travel far. It was already in the air, mixing with the damp peat smoke, waiting only for a voice to give it direction. In late 17th century Scotland, witchcraft wasn't a distant fear or a campfire story. It was a living, breathing threat in the minds of ordinary people. Imagine being a farmer who wakes up to find the family cow unable to stand. To us, it might be sickness, but in Paisley, it was the work of a witch. People believed witches could steal milk right from the udder, sour butter in the churn, or eat even make hens stop laying with a muttered curse. Even crops weren't safe. If the barley rotted in the field or frost killed the potatoes, it wasn't seen as bad weather. Someone had called misfortune down on you. Seafarers were especially wary. Fishing villages whispered that witches raised storms with knots tied in a rope. Untie one knot and a breeze would come. Untie the second and the seas would rise. Lose the third and a tempest would destroy ships. Sailors sometimes carried iron nails in their pockets to ward off this kind of magic. Mothers, too, had their own fears. They spoke of witches who could steal the breath of infants and who sent fairy sickness into children that left them wasting away with no explanation. This wasn't just folklore. It shaped the courts, the churches, and even family relationships. If a baby died or someone fell mysteriously ill, people looked for the witch in their midst. And that's why accusations cut so deeply. They weren't abstract. They were tied to the hardships of everyday life.
Damn.
This is not just a historical account episode. It's a true crime story as well. One where the crime is the accusation itself. And it's just in time for spooky season. We're going to expose a community's descent into a madness far more terrifying than any supernatural force. So on Monday, we did the Salem Witch Trials. So while there, it has become a cautionary tale that's taught in classrooms. Contrast to that, Paisley's tragedy ended with a brutal finality that marked the end of an entire era.
Dang.
The final mass execution for witchcraft in Eastern Europe. Today, we're not just going to be telling you a story. We're stepping back in time to understand how a perfect storm of religious fervor, devastating poverty, social anxiety, and sheer terror could lead to an act of unspeakable cruelty. This is a deep dive into the Paisley Witch Trials, a forgotten chapter in history that holds a powerful, chilling lesson for us all. So while Salem is famous for the governor's eventual remorse and the pardoning of many victims, Paisley's case was far more brutal. It involved burning and had an official legislative finality that signed the ambiguous end of the witch hunt era in Britain. Never heard of this one, huh?
No, but I know Britons are weird. Well, their culture is so much different than ours.
Yeah.
That it's weird to us, and I'm sure ours is weird to them.
Oh, yeah. I watched, there's one guy on TikTok, I can't remember his name, but he's great. He comes to America. And it's so funny because he did a TikTok video where he was talking about how, like, their washer and dryer isn't here in America. Our washer and dryer isn't in our kitchen. But in his home, which is called a flat where he lives.
Right.
His washer and dryer is in the kitchen.
I'd love to have a washer and dryer in the kitchen.
So he's like, is this normal in every American home? And then he went and stayed in the Appalachian Mountains once he did some videos.
Well, now there's a culture shock for him.
Right. Did videos on that. He's great. He tries new food here. He talks about how it's totally, like, they don't have a lot of the food we have here there. So it's totally
new to him.
It's polar opposites, really. It's great. So when we talk about witch trials, most people automatically picture Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. But Scotland had a far longer and bloodier history with witchcraft than we had here.
Dang. Talk about brutal.
Right. So between 1560 and 1736, an estimated 4,000 to 6,000 people were accused, and perhaps 2/3 of them were executed.
Dang.
Mm-hmm. How we don't know about the Paisley Witch Trials compared to Salem, I don't understand. I just so happened while I was researching for the Salem Trials, that's how I found this one. Never heard of it. It's wild.
It's not taught in schools.
No. And maybe because of where it's at, I don't know.
Could be.
So proportionately, this made Scotland one of the deadliest places in Europe for alleged witches.
I'd be moving from there.
Right. Salem, in comparison, saw fewer than 200 accusations and only 20 executions.
Who did?
Salem did.
Yeah.
So nothing in comparison to this. Yeah. Well, to Scotland as a whole.
Right.
So the key difference lies in how the trials unfolded. Salem's hysteria was a sudden wildfire, burning bright for a little more than a year before dying down. Scotland's persecution stretched over generations, with peaks during times of famine, plague, and political instability. In Paisley, the trial of 1697 was not an isolated moment, but a part of a long legacy of suspicion. By the time Christian Shaw pointed her finger at neighbors, Scotland had already executed thousands, and ministers preached weekly sermons on the reality of witchcraft. And while Salem has entered popular imagination through books, plays, films, the Scottish trials remain less known, perhaps because they were so numerous, so widespread, and lasted so long that no one single episode stood apart from the rest.
Dang.
But the Paisley witch trials, with their curse and their memorial, stands as one of the most infamous of the Scotland witch trials. So, we're going to get into it. Now, before we step into Paisley, we have to talk about the human body and mind as they were understood in 1697. So to us, Christian Shaw's symptoms, the convulsions, loss of feeling, the sudden theatrical fits, sound like a textbook case of modern medical or psychological condition, like the conversion disorder or severe epilepsy.
Right.
Back then, it was witches. The neighbors' notebooks and later depositions paint a public theater. One witness recalled Christian, quote, falling back as if gripped by the heart, fingernails white on the bench, a sound like a stifled horn came from her chest. Another said that she had seen the girl's body jerk as if pulled, her limbs folding in ways that made grown men step back. People swore that Christian spewed odd objects in the fits. Pins, tufts of hair, a small scrap of wool, items that seemed to local eyes to be the product of malice rather than medicine. Whether these accounts are sincere, exaggerated, or the result of suggestible crowds, they were vivid, horrific, and they circulated like wildfire, dry, plentiful, and fueling the blaze. But for the physicians of the time, the world was governed by the theory of four humors. An imbalance could cause illness, and a complete violent collapse of the body was often seen as something beyond the natural world. Doctors like our mentioned Dr. Bisvim were aware of conditions that could mimic possession. But when a condition became as bizarre and as public as Christian's, the prevailing belief was that the human body was being manipulated by an outside demonic force. The mind was simply the vessel of the soul. And if the vessel was acting strangely, it could only be because the devil was reaching in to steer it. In this world, there was no separation between physical and spiritual affliction.
They can honestly say the devil made me do it.
Right. So a disease of the body could be, and often was, also a disease of the soul. So now to understand that fervor of the Scottish witch hunts, we must go back nearly a century to the reign of King James VI. He was a monarch with a profound and dangerous obsession with witchcraft. After surviving what he believed was a magical conspiracy to kill him and his queen in the North Berwick witch trials of the 1590s, James became convinced that he was a special target of the devil. His personal terror led him to write and publish the Demonology, a treatise on the subject of witchcraft. So it's spelled different, but we talked about it in the Salem Witch Trials episode. It's spelled different, and it might be pronounced just a little different because of the language and the dialect, but it's a book on demonology is what it is. So King James didn't write in the quiet of an armchair. He wrote with fury and with purpose. In demonology, he cataloged not just superstition, but a prosecutor's manual. Detailed descriptions of familiars, how witches could rise with the wind, and methods to root them out. Scottish magistrates and ministers read it like it was scripture. In one famous practical aside, James argued that witches could conspire to harm the crown itself, which meant that accusations of witchcraft could be framed not merely as spiritual failings, but as treason.
Dang.
Mm-hmm. That framing put the full weight of state power behind witch hunting. An accusation could now be presented as a defense of the realm. Published in 1597, the book itself was more than just a royal curiosity. It was a pseudo-scholarly handbook for witch hunters. In it, James laid out his theories on how witches would use familiars to do their bidding and how they would gather in covens to worship Satan. Crucially, under Scottish law, the 1563 Witchcraft Act categorized witchcraft not merely as a religious offense, but as lèse majesté, I think is how you say it, or an act of treason against the monarch. The devil's aim, according to James, was to overthrow the divinely ordained king. Therefore, the witch hunt was seen by the state as a necessary police action to suppress sedition and protect the realm, giving the trials their brutal state-sanctioned finality. This royal endorsement gave the legal system ministers and magistrates the moral and intellectual justification that they needed. For the next century, demonology was a key text in Scottish courts. How wild is that?
Somebody's got on some good drugs over there.
Oh my God. So this legacy was amplified by the literal collapse of society. So this was Scotland in the late 17th century, a place defined by its fierce Presbyterian faith, but also by devastating poverty. The 1690s were known as the Seven Ill Years. They had repeated crop failures, particularly of oats and barley, which led to widespread famine. So historians estimate that in some parishes, up to 20% of the population died from starvation or disease during those years. So imagine granaries with cracked lids and mice-stripped sacks, fields that were turned only thin, ragged shoots where lush oats had once risen, whole rows of planted seeds swallowed by late frosts. Parish records mention extra pauper lists and full churchyards. People parted what few heirlooms they had for sacks of meal. Mothers measured how long a child could go without bread and still cling to hope. Villagers who had always shared what little they had owned began to keep doors bolted and pans empty for fear of being left with nothing. In this climate, misfortune demanded a culprit more concrete than just bad weather. Someone to point to, someone to blame, and someone to punish. When people are starving, the community demands an explanation that isn't just bad luck. The ministers of the Kirk provided it. They preached a powerful doctrine of predestination and a constant act of war between God and the devil. The devil was not a metaphor. He was a very real, very present enemy who sought to destroy the righteous. In this climate of fear and faith, every misfortune was easily blamed on a satanic plot in their very midst. So it all began in August of 1696. The Shaw family was one of the wealthiest and most respected in Renfrewshire. Young Christian Shaw was just 11 years old, and she lived a privileged life. A life that came to a screeching, terrifying halt because of a seemingly small incident. Christian caught one of the family servants, a young woman named Catherine Campbell, stealing a drink of milk. When Christian threatened to tell her mother, a furious Christian cursed the child, wishing misfortune upon her. So when Christian soon fell mysteriously ill, the community saw it as irrefutable evidence of a curse put into motion. At first, her illness represented simple fainting fits or seizures. But her fits quickly grew stranger, more theatrical, and far more alarming. Christian claims she felt invisible hands pinching, pricking, and choking her.
That sounds familiar.
She screamed of spirits tormenting her, clawing at her flesh. Witnesses swore they saw her be lifted or pulled by unseen forces. Her small body jostled and thrown about a room with no visible cause. On one specific preserve day, the 3rd of September, Christian's mother claimed her daughter's body was twisted into an unnatural position for an hour. Her eyes rolled back, and the only sound was a faint, raspy prayer. But the most grotesque and disturbing detail was Christian's inexplicable vomitings. From her small mouth, she would expel impossible objects. Tufts of hair, bits of straw, feathers, small stones, bent pins, and even lumps of coal.
Dang! Girl's got a crappy diet.
Mm-hmm. A highly respected physician, Dr. Brisbane, I mentioned earlier, he was from Glasgow, was called to witness this horror. He observed as she spewed a piece of hot coal as big as a chestnut, unable to offer a medical explanation. He declared the affliction was preternatural. To a community steeped in superstition, the message was clear. This was undeniable proof that the devil was at work. She could have also just had pica. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, but they didn't know that back
then. Well, no, they didn't. But that's probably what she had. She probably just had pica and was just eating random shit.
But why would she eat a hot coal?
Pica makes you do weird shit.
Yeah, well, that'd burn your asshole all the way.
But was it actually hot or was it exaggerated? We don't know.
More likely it was exaggerated.
Yeah, we don't know.
That is crazy.
So with every new fit, Christian's list of tormentors grew. Her first accusation was personal. Catherine Campbell, the servant. But soon, the circle of suspicion widened to over 30 names.
Damn!
Neighbors, distant relatives, and even complete strangers. This wasn't a random list. It was targeted. The kindling for this fire was social and economic anxiety. The accused were almost exclusively women, often elderly, poor, or widowed, people already on the fringes. Among those caught in the net was Agnes Naismith, an elderly woman known as a solitary figure with a sharp tongue. She was an easy target. Before the trial, Agnes had a simple human life. She had lost her husband during the Civil Wars and relied on selling small knitted goods for income. When her neighbor's cow fell ill, they remembered a harsh word Agnes had given them years ago, and it was all the proof they needed. Her past grievances were reinterpreted as evidence of a demonic pact. Also accused was Margaret Fulton, a beggar and a mentally unhinged woman with no one to defend her. She reportedly went mad in prison, muttering incoherently about visiting Elfland and the Obadi of the Fairies. A fantastical testimony the court took as proof of her consorting with the supernatural. Or she was just mentally ill. The accusations had also swept up the Weavers, John and James Lindsay. They were targeted after John had a bitter documented disagreement with Christian's family, the wealthy Shaws, over the cost and quality of a piece of cloth. This hints at a darker motive, a self-serving purge that benefited the powerful at the expense of the weak. And finally, there was John Reed, a devout weaver from a neighboring town, tragically swept up in these accusations. Knowing his fate and unable to bear the prison conditions, he tragically took his own life by hanging himself with a rope before he could face the courts. The six who faced execution in Paisley weren't strangers to their community. Each had a name, a face, and a history that stretched through the muddy streets and small cottages of the town. Agnes Naismith, the oldest, was already marked by suspicion. Like I said, she was widowed, outspoken, and past her prime. She didn't fit neatly into the role society had allowed women. Old age itself was enough to draw whispers. If you were poor and lived long, people wondered what bargains you had struck. John Lindsay was just a boy. He was around 11 or 12. Too young to understand the full weight of the accusations, but old enough to be swept up by them. Children weren't spared when fear took hold. He likely sat through interrogations terrified, unsure of why the adults around him insisted he name names. Margaret Lang and Margaret Fulton were women in their 30s, both part of Paisley's working poor. They would have known hardship intimately. Too much familiarity with herbs or too many quarrels with neighbors could have put them on the wrong side of suspicion. Catherine Campbell was rumored to have been outspoken, possibly a woman who talked back when she shouldn't have, and in a patriarchal society that was dangerous. And John Reed, like the other, was also a familiar face, someone whose presence in the town would have been unremarkable until the moment he was accused. Together, these six formed a cross-section of the vulnerable, old, young, poor, female, and outsider in one way or another. When the community turned on them, it wasn't because of who they were, but because they fit the mold of who witches were supposed to be. The ministers of the Paisley Kirk were the engine of this fire. They interpreted Christians' condition as proof that the devil was actively working through witches in their midst. Sermons warned of hidden evil and public fasts were held, giving immense spiritual weight to the children's words. The result was that the community began watching one another more closely than ever. Old grudges became deadly. A neighbor's odd glance, a servant's absence, any anomaly became evidence of complicity with Satan. Fear was no longer personal. It was communal, contagious, and deadly. This phenomenon today is known as mass hysteria or social contagion, a state where anxiety can manifest physically, turning a community's collective delusion into a deadly shared reality. So by early 1697, the state had intervened. The Privy Council of Scotland, which is the nation's highest court, granted a special commission to bring the accused to trial. This was no rogue local court. The state itself had come to Paisley to stamp out what it saw as an incursion of pure evil. The proceedings were a grotesque charade of justice. The main evidence was Christian Shaw's testimony, which was taken as divine and unimpeachable. Judges would watch as she fell into convulsions, and then, while blindfolded, she would be made to touch the accused. If her fits intensified upon contact, it was considered undeniable proof of guilt. Adding to the unique cruelty of Scottish law, the final judgment was delivered not by a single judge, but by a jury of 15 men. In England, a jury usually delivered a unanimous verdict. But in Scotland, a simple majority was enough to condemn someone to death. So if 10 out of the 15 thought they were guilty, that was it. You're guilty. You're going to die. So the structural detail meant the guilt was widely distributed. The justice was not the fault of one zealot, but of a majority of neighbors. The community essentially judged and executed itself, making the final burning feel less like state enforcement and more like a mass communal act of self-destruction. But the evidence that sealed their fate came from brutal torture methods sanctioned by the court. What's justice without a little bit of torture? You know.
I don't know. There's a few people I'd like to torture. Just saying.
So the witch prickers, which we talked about in the Salem episode, that had been hired by the court profited from this hysteria as well. Just like in Salem. So these prickers arrived with instruments and a solemn face. What they called the devil's mark was often a mundane skin patch, a mole, a scar, an area of numbness, anything like that, that could be simply natural. Using long, blunt needles, they would prod and watch. When a mark seemed not to bleed or the subject grimaced in any way, a verdict was declared. Yeah. It's weird. So sometimes deliberate tricks were used. So repeated prodding, threats, or even the pre-selection of spots on bodies that was already thought to be suspicious. Sleep deprivation and forced vigils did the rest. After days without rest, prisoners would begin to hallucinate. They told stories that they never would have. They named neighbors, recanted, and then named more. The system was circular. Accusation led to torture. Torture produced confessions. Confessions produced more accusations. They claimed to be searching for the devil's mark, an insensitive spot on the body that wouldn't feel pain or bleed. In a sophisticated con, they would use blunt pins to prick a mole or one of those other marks. They would then solemnly announce the devil's mark had been found, delivering a death sentence based on a parlor trick. In a final act of forensic failure, the devil's mark that the pricker sought was often nothing more than the things that I mentioned before, as well as a skin tag, a birthmark, anything like that that today is recognized as an insensible spot on the body, which is caused by a cutaneous nerve disorder or simply old scar tissue. Because if you have a skin tag, like, you know it's there, but there's no feeling there. Moles typically don't have feeling. So they use that to be able to say, oh, you have a witch's mark. Yep.
Well, Debbie would pass the test because you just touch her in the wrong spot with her fibromyalgia.
Yeah. So the accused were also subject to days of agonizing sleep deprivation. They were pushed past the point of endurance until, like I said, they would hallucinate and then confess to anything. These confessions included consorting with the devil, flying through the air, or plotting to harm Christian Shaw herself. This was a classic example of coercion. Under modern law, any confession contained through this duress would be immediately inadmissible hearsay. The legal framework here was a trap. You deny the charges and you were lying. Confess and you sealed your fate and were forced to name names, fueling the hysteria. The chilling irony is that the properties and meager possessions of the condemned were often confiscated and sold off to pay for the trial and the execution costs. Records show a local figure, Bailiff Andrew Cumming, personally oversaw the auction of Margaret Fulton's few possessions, turning the church's holy war into his own cynical personal profit. Historians later calculated the total cost of the Paisley Special Commission, covering the travel and lodging for the judges, the pay for the witch prickers, and the executioner's final fee. This was an enormous burden, likely equivalent to the entire annual income of a local parish. This makes the Paisley witch trials a definitive example of state-sanctioned murder that was not only religiously zealous and financially corrupt, but devastatingly expensive for the public as well. The community was not just spending its collective sanity, it was spending its entire savings to purchase the death of its weakest members. In early June, the court delivered its judgment. 7 people, 4 women, and 3 men were found guilty of witchcraft. So, the morning of June 10th, 1697, was a day that would forever mark the town of Paisley. The 6 surviving condemned individuals were led to Gallow Green, a hill outside of Paisley where the crowd had gathered. As the condemned were marched through the streets, many townspeople performed a simple superstition, turning their pockets inside out to protect themselves from the witch's final malignant gaze. The execution process began, forcing the town to look at the people that they had sentenced. First in line was Agnes Naismith, once a spinner of yarn, now a widow living alone on the edge of town. She kept to herself, mending nets and trading a bit of wool for bread. People remembered her saying sharp things in Market Rows, and in a culture that prizes obedience, a tongue like hers became a liability. Her independence read like guilt. Stumbling behind her was Margaret Fulton, thin, trembling, a woman many in Paisley crossed the street to avoid. She had no kin to stand for her and no roof warm enough for winter. Hunger carved hollows in her cheeks, and she was accused not for malice, but for being visible in a town desperate to explain misfortune. Next was Margaret Lang, a woman with healer hands who once sought out for her salves and teas, but in famine years, her remedies became suspect. When Christian pointed to her, the herbs in her basket became poisons in the court's imagination. Neighbors who once came quietly to her door with fevers or rashes now whispered that she brewed not cures, but curses. A sprig of rosemary became evidence in sorcery. A jar of dried foxglove became a pact with the devil. Margaret had no husband to shield her, no wealth to buy her silence. All she had were her remedies, and in the courtroom, those remedies were twisted into proof of witchcraft. These women were followed by the weavers, John and James Lindsay. whose livelihoods were tied to cloth and contract. John had argued publicly with the Shaw family about a poor quality piece of cloth. In a town where reputation was currency, that argument became a stain. When the Shaws needed scapegoats, they could point to a shopkeeper who they had quarreled with and called it evidence. James, his brother, was taken in that same net. Guilt by bloodline. Condemned for proximity as much as deed.
Jeez.
Their story was one of craft turned against its makers. The same loons that clothed their neighbors became in court the backdrop for whispers of enchanted cloth and curses woven into linen. In truth, the only thing they wove was livelihood, but in a climate of fear, a quarrel over price could be made to sound like proof of pacts with Satan. The last woman in line was Catherine Campbell, remembered as stern, sharp-eyed, with little patience for gossip. She lived near the edge of Paisley, where her family's land had dwindled to almost nothing. Resentment made her memorable, and in these trials, being memorable was dangerous. Neighbors whispered that her curses lingered longer than most, and so her name entered the court records. But Catherine was also practical. She stretched scrapes into suppers, nursed sick kin when no minister called, and did the quiet labor of survival on land the Shaw family's privilege had long since insulated them from.
Yeah.
When Christian's accusations reached her door, the memory of a snapped word at market or a furrowed brow in church was all it took to transform her into a villain. Her sharpness, which once kept her family fed, was recast as malice. That is because the procession was one person short. John Reed. A devout weaver from a neighboring parish, he was described in the briefest of records as handsome, troubled, and he was tragically absent. His quiet, piety, and a history of fainting spells made him vulnerable. Facing prison conditions he could not bear, he had taken his own life by hanging himself with a rope before he could face the court. Reed's story, and perhaps the most tragic, a man whose faith was steady, whose health betrayed him, and whose end was a desperate attempt to seize control over a fate already decided. In choosing his own rope, he denied the court its spectacle, yet the fire still claimed him. As if to erase any final act of agency, his name lingers only in fragments of records, a reminder that silence and despair were as much victims as the flames. Even in death, his body was condemned and would be burned with the others. So the six left were led one by one to the gallows. They were first strangled, a process that was often slow and agonizing. The crowd that morning was a living beast, a mass of wool caps, smeared faces, and lantern lights. Mothers clutching children who could not look away, men with pockets turned inside out, and a superstition more comforting than rationale. The convicted walked with shackles that made each step a labor, their coats dull with the grime of holding cells. When the executioner pulled the rope, the sound was mechanical, but the reaction was human. A collective intake, a rustle like dried leaves. There was a sharp, hot smell of tar readied in barrels and an acrid tang of lit peat. Men murmured prayers, some prayed for mercy, some for vengeance. After the strangling, when the bodies were cut down and set into tar barrels, the flames leapt up in a sudden and almost ceremonial cruelty. The crackling drowned out prayers and gasps alike. The sound of flesh and fabric giving way became a terrible procession under the sky. The crowd did not disperse quickly. People stayed long after the flames had burned themselves low, as if proximity to that punishment could purge or reassure them. So they hung them, but as we said in Salem, they were really strangled. Because it was done completely differently than years later.
Right.
Then their bodies were placed in barrels of tar and set on fire.
Yeah.
This fire was intended to consume them entirely. This was done to ensure their bodies could not be resurrected and their souls would forever be consigned to eternal damnation. But local legend says that also was not the end. As Agnes Naismith stood on the gallows, she allegedly looked out at the crowd, and with her last breath, she laid a final chilling curse on the town and its people. She specifically cursed the executioner and the commissioners, promising them a painful and lingering end, and foretelling the economic ruin of the town's chief industries. Whether she really cursed them, or it was a dying woman's rage given shape by rumor, the words stuck. And in the decades after, any brewer fire, any failed crop, or factory closure drew a mourner's finger back toward those gallows and the memory of Agnes's voice. Mill owners who lost contracts blamed the curse. Town councils that mismangled funds were said to have felt the tightening. In truth, though, Paisley faced the same economic pressures as any textile town. Competition, changing markets, and technological disruption. Yet the curse gave a human face to what would otherwise be complex, impersonal forces. Now, by the 19th and 20th centuries, families would still murmur about Agnes's day as they closed a failing loom. Written local histories collected those anecdotes as if they were part of the town's moral ledger, a ledger with vivid ink and a stain that would never lift. For centuries, every local misfortune had been jokingly or seriously attributed to Agnes Naismith's curse. So the ashes of those that were condemned were then buried at the spot where they had died. They then placed a large horseshoe over their grave.
Like they did in Salem.
Mm-hmm. Supposedly to keep the spirits from returning to haunt the town. That horseshoe itself went missing in the 1960s. A disappearance that some in the town still claim is the reason for Paisley's economic struggles today. The horseshoes vanishing made good fuel for the late night storytellers. Teenagers dared each other to visit the witch's stone at midnight. A small clutch of local retirees swore they'd once heard the hooves of a phantom horse on a night when no horse could be seen. People who walked gallow green in autumn tell of a sudden cold that seems to have its own taste, metallic and old. And some swear they have smelled peat and tar where no fire could have been lit for decades. So whether you call it residual grief, suggestion, or genuine haunting, these stories perform a social work. They keep the memory alive and remind a town that what was done cannot be entirely undone. It's the kind of folklore that blurs the line between guilt and memorial, a living town carrying a nocturnal whisper of what it paid for its peace. The disappearance of the horseshoe remains an unsolved local mystery. Was it stolen as a relic, or was it an intentional ritualistic removal, perhaps by someone intending to or believing that they could break the curse Agnes Naismith had laid on the town and freeing her spirit along with the spirit of the others? Nobody knows.
That's kind of creepy to think about.
Right, this horseshoe just vanished.
That's probably teenagers.
Probably. The most haunting part of this story, though, is not the tragedy of the condemned, but the prosperity of the accuser. So after the execution, Christian Shaw's fits ceased entirely. She went on to live a remarkably successful life. She became an entrepreneur and one of the founders of the Scottish textile industry. She founded a company and developed a distinct fine thread known as Bargarian thread, named after her family's estate.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, I haven't either, so hopefully I said it right.
It's probably something that's over in Europe.
Probably. So the chilling irony is inescapable. Christian built her considerable wealth using thread, a common symbolic tool in witchcraft accusations.
Effort.
The very image of a spindle or a tangled knot had sent women like Agnes and Margaret to their deaths, yet it became the foundation of Christian's fortune. Every coin she earned, every spool of thread she sold, carried with it the memory of seven lives that had been extinguished. Her prosperity was not just financial, it was a public vindication. The community that had once gathered to watch bodies burn now applauded her success, as if the pyre itself had purified her.
You need to be slapped.
In the silence of her later years, one wonders whether Christian ever heard the voices of those that she had condemned. A sharp-tongued widow, a trembling beggar, a healer with her herbs, a weaver with his debts, or whether she simply spun her thread tighter, weaving their absence into the very fabric of Scotland's industry. Christian's life after the trials read like a paradox. Where once her body's fit made her a vessel for supernatural authority, she became a figure of industry modernity, leasing looms, employing workers, and marketing her wares. Margaron Thread carried the name of her estate and the stamp of a woman who had become not only unclaimed, but successful. Men who had watched her convulse now signed papers for her business. It raises uncomfortable questions. Did she genuinely recover? Or did the succession of fits simply coincide with the transfer of power from spectacle to enterprise? A few contemporary letters hint at troubling attitudes. Some lauded her God-given prudence in trade. Others privately wondered if the same force that had tormented her had now been turned into profit. Either way, the townsfolk who survived bore the scars and the stigma while her loom turned. The brutality of the Paisley trials were so extreme that it drew condemnation across Scotland. The legal proceedings were seen as a disgrace, and the commissioners who presided over the trial were formally reprimanded by the Privy Council. The 23 accused who were not executed were eventually released. And only after being financially ruined by months of imprisonment and heavy fines, forever branded as associates of the devil. These individuals emerged from prison with nothing. Their homes often seized, their trades ruined, and their names stained forever. For many, this ruin was a slower, colder death than the fire. They became the living ghosts of Paisley. Visible reminders that even those deemed not guilty by the state were still utterly destroyed by the justice system's failure. In total, the Paisley witch trials didn't just claim 7 lives. They demolished the reputations and livelihoods of over 30 people across the region.
That's crazy.
Yep. Just in one area. Among those released, but utterly ruined, was Catherine Campbell, the servant whose initial curse started the entire tragedy.
If she just had to stole that sip of milk, now this would have happened.
She just wanted a little bit of milk. Just a drink.
But I'm saying, if she hadn't done it, none of this would have happened.
I feel like it probably would have eventually.
But it wouldn't have been because of her.
Right, right. It had been just for some other stupid fucking reason.
Right.
Just one drink of milk. Seriously, people.
Let her have the flipping milk. Right. Jeez Louise. Everybody needs milk.
Fuck. It's not that serious. Anyway.
Yeah, but back in those days it was, though, honey.
Yeah, yeah. You look at somebody sideways and...
Right? Hell, if that had been the case, I'd have been deemed a witch a whole long time ago.
Me too. Every day.
Right, and then some.
Yep, sometimes twice a day.
Sometimes twice on Sunday.
Sometimes more than that. Because if my mouth don't say it, my face will.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so while her mistress, Christian Shaw, went on to become a wealthy industrialist, Catherine faded into historical obscurity. Her life became a footnote of poverty and social exile. A powerful contrast to the prosperity of the Shaw family. The tragedy ended not with a bang, but with a divided legacy. Wealth for the privileged accuser, and silent, enduring ruin for the impoverished one. The rising influence of the Enlightenment, with its focus on reason, evidence, and skepticism, began to erode the foundations of the witch hunts. The final official act came with the Witchcraft Act of 1736. Which is crazy to me that they even had to have that.
I know.
Like, honestly. Anyway. This repelled the laws that made witchcraft a capital offense in Britain. The tragedy of Paisley was a dark finality. A moment so extreme that it helped bring an end to a centuries-old terror. Seen through a modern lens, Paisley is a lesson in how social panic, bad law, and weak evidence combine into injustice. Psychologists point to mass psychogenic illness, real symptoms that are produced by shared stress and suggestion, as one way to explain the outbreak of these fits. Others suggest fictitious disorder, where an individual might unconsciously or consciously produce symptoms for social reward, attention, or power. Legally, the trials are a cautionary tale about confirmation bias, coerced confession, and the dangers of allowing fear to replace rigorous standards of evidence. Today, we still see echoes. False confessions, flawed forensic techniques, and media-fed moral panics that remake ordinary people into monsters overnight.
That's the truth.
Paisley asks us to consider how easily community truth can become community cruelty, and how much repair is required when an entire little legal system errs. So today, at the site of the execution, a memorial stands as a silent testament to the innocent lives lost. The Witch's Stone, a circular bronze disc, bears a simple, poignant inscription: pain inflicted, suffering endured, injustice done. This monument serves as the town's modern apology, and an poignant modern effort to right these historical wrongs. Groups like the Witches of Scotland are currently campaigning for an official pardon for the victims because they still have not been pardoned. What modern activists are seeking is a formal recognition of the ultimate crime committed by the 1697 court. Not just an error, but a mass wrongful conviction, a concept that sadly remains acutely relevant to our justice systems today. In recent years, the memory has become political as well as commemorative. Groups campaigning for formal pardons argue that apologies matter not just as sentiment, but as civic repair, an admission that institutions got it wrong, and that living institutions should be better when faced with fear and bad evidence. The Witches of Scotland and other advocacy groups have pressed for symbolic gestures and legal recognition. And in doing so, they turn a spooky story into a living conversation about justice, evidence, and how communities remember trauma. For us as listeners, this spooky season, the lesson is plain. The monsters we fear most are sometimes made by people like us. And the only cure is a little humility, a lot of skepticism, and an insistence that institutions protect the vulnerable rather than scapegoat them.
Unfortunately, that's been going on for hundreds and thousands of years.
Yep. So that changes. I don't know. I don't have much faith in that. It just looks different. Same thing. It just looks different. And yet some of these stories are never truly put to rest, like we just said. The Witch's Stone is not the only enduring symbol. To this day, local lore tells a supernatural phenomena at the Gallow Green site, with some claiming to hear phantom cries and whispers on the wind. At Gallow Green itself, where the fires raged, visitors sometimes report a sudden metallic chill followed by the brief, sharp smell of burnt meat. A ghastly memory of the bodies consumed to ash.
Well, that's because they're buried right there, right?
Their ashes were, yeah.
Okay. You can't get the smell of burning flesh out of anything.
No. Not only that, it's the smell of death.
Is that right? That's what there actually is. It's the smell
of
death.
Yeah, it's just not something that goes away. No. The Bargarin estate, where it all began, is also said to be haunted, with spectral figures of a tormented girl and a mournful servant seen in the windows. Witnesses have reported smelling the sharp scent of burning tar and peat near the grounds, a chilling sensory echo of the execution. And so all of this leaves us with a final chilling question. What really happened to Christian Shaw's mind? Did her psychological or neurological condition truly abate after her executions? Or did the trauma she witnessed, the seven lives of her accusations destroyed, simply break her mind to the point where her symptoms were replaced with a more silent, hidden condition? Some psychologists today might suggest that she suffered from a fictitious disorder, or that she knowingly embraced the power that her fits gave her. But the terrifying truth remains that in a world that could not accept a medical explanation, a community chose a horrifying spiritual one. The result was not a curse, but a stain on history and a haunting reminder of the true cost of unchecked fear. The final chilling horror of Paisley is that the greatest testament to this tragedy is not the Witch's Stone, but the wealth and success of the Bargarian Thread Company, a business literally founded by the fiery deaths of innocents. And that's the Paisley Witch Trials.
That was some crazy people.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it was one girl did all of that.
Little brat needed her butt busted.
Right. Whereas in Salem, it was
several.
Several.
Yeah, several girls.
Mm-hmm. And far less people.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. How we don't know about the Paisley trials? I don't know.
That was wild.
Right.
You know, and she just could have had epilepsy.
Yep.
But epilepsy never, see, the thing is, though, epilepsy never goes away.
No.
And they didn't have medication for it back
then. And
in those
as
days.
Far as they know, it went away. Maybe it didn't actually go away. Maybe because, you know, medical advances happen.
No, you know, it never goes away.
Well, it's no, it doesn't go away.
Medicine.
Yeah, that's what I bet.
But back then, they didn't have that.
Or maybe she was a witch.
Never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just slap her and get it over with.
You're so funny. Okay. That's all we got. You have any final thought?
These people be crazy.
All right, guys. I think Mandy will be back on Monday.
Yay! No, I'm kidding. I've enjoyed this. Don't get me wrong. But I like listening to the girls better.
But yeah, I think she'll be back on Monday. I believe that's the plan for her to be back on Monday. She won't be here back on Monday. But she'll be back on the podcast Monday. That's the plan. So
I'm confused.
She'll still be there.
Don't How are you going to do it?
Virtually?
Okay. Well, I don't know nothing about this stuff.
Yeah, huh? Yeah. We'll record it virtually because she won't be here because she's still there dealing with some of
that mess.
Yeah, some of that stuff that's going on. Hopefully, she'll be back here.
This might soon. Give her a nice break too.
Right. Right.
Doing the podcast with you.
Yeah. So she'll be back on Monday. That's the plan. Be a good one. So make sure you come back on Monday. I believe that'll be another one where Mandy and I take turns. That'll be fun.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah. Yep. That one's a Monday. So make sure you come back for that one.
Did that one already come out that we did took turns?
Yeah.
So I can say it?
Yeah.
The lakes, mm-hmm. The haunted lakes.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
Yep.
That was fun.
Yeah, we've got a couple of those that are like that. They're fun to switch it up sometimes.
Oh, it's always fun to switch stuff up. You know that.
Yep.
I've taught you that all your life.
So, that one is Monday. Mandy should be back with your Mandy's voice. Don't forget to subscribe so you get notifications, hit your bell, all of that. Make sure you give us a rate and a review. This helps new listeners find us. So that way we can give you more content, better content, give you all the things. And with all of that, we hope you keep listening and remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.